From Welcome Villain Films, the studio that brought you the horror hit Malum, as well as Beaten to Death and Hunter Killer, comes their newest nightmare, Mind, Body, Spirit, now available on digital. Directed by Alex Haynes and Matthew Miranda, and produced by Dan Asma, Mind, Body, Spirit follows Anya, an aspiring yoga influencer, as she embarks on a ritual practice left behind by her estranged grandmother. What starts as a spiritual self-help guide quickly evolves into something much more sinister, as Anya becomes increasingly obsessed with the mysterious power of the practice. She unwittingly unleashes an otherworldly entity that begins to take control of her life and her videos. Now, Anya must race to unlock the truth before her descent into madness threatens to consume her mind, body, and spirit. During its festival tour, with stops at Chattanooga Film Festival and the Unnamed Footage Festival, Mind, Body, Spirit garnered praise from critics who call it a found footage version of Hereditary and a knockout found footage horror movie for the live stream era. Experience the first ever yoga-themed found footage horror film, and don't miss the film viewers have called extremely frightening and upsetting. Available now on digital anywhere you rent or buy movies online, including Prime Video and Apple Plus.
I'm Mick Garris, and this is Postmortem. Every now and again, an independent genre film makes a huge splash at film festivals, breaks beyond the horrorgencia and into the cinema mainstream. A buzz builds around it, and it becomes the eye of the horror hurricane. It happened with It Follows, The Witch, Train to Busan, Raw, and Get Out, among others. The movie that's the center of attention now is Hereditary, and the film's writer-director, Ari Aster, is with us to share how the movie came to be.
You are now listening to Postmortem with Mick Garris, where the most influential voices in horror cinema will spill their guts, literally, to the renowned horror director, writer, and producer. Now, here's your host, Mick Garris.
Ari, thank you so much for being here. You are the talk of the town right now. And how does that feel? I mean, this movie exploded at Sundance, not at a genre festival, but at Sundance. So tell me about what led up to that and what it felt like that night.
We hadn't finished the film when it premiered at Sundance.
Oh, still, really?
Yeah, we had not finished the visual effects. In fact, we had to make sort of a last-minute decision about whether we were going to accept Sundance's invitation because we needed 2 months at least for the the visual effects, and we had about 2.5 weeks to finish them if we were going to, well, not to finish them, but to get what we could done for the premiere if we were going to accept the invitation. And of course we did, and I'm so happy we did.
Well, and the movie doesn't rely on the visual effects much.
I mean,
it's a very character-oriented and story-oriented film.
Yeah. No, that's true. But hopefully, you know, a lot of those visual effects are kind of invisible at this point.
Right.
But they were less invisible at that premiere.
You saw the wires and green walls and things.
You saw more than I wanted you to see.
Okay.
The seams were, you know...
Evident.
It was lousy with seams. But So, because of that, I think I had maybe exaggerated all those things in my head, and I was very worried about screening the film, and I was just convinced that everybody was going to think it was a piece of shit, and the first screening was like torture, because people were very, very quiet, and it is a film that it's a heavy film,
yeah.
And so that could mean either that people are like really in the grip of it and they're being affected, or it could mean that they're just like bored out of their mind and anyway, that's what happens when you first like screen a film.
So you show up at Park City,
yeah,
and there's the theater, and there's the line all the way around the theater, and so what were your thoughts as you're going in? You know that even that night, people had been talking up how powerful the movie is.
Well, the first night, nobody had been talking it up. Like, nobody had seen it.
So
it was just, what is this? It's a first-time filmmaker. Toni Collette's in it. A24 is involved. There's, like, some level of expectation, but really not really. I think I think that a couple of the programmers at Sundance were pretty vocal about, you know, really loving it, which was great. I know that Landon Zackheim has been like a really great.
Landon's great. Yeah, he runs the Overlook Film Festival as well, which I'm part of.
And we played there, and that was amazing. Yeah. It's such an amazing festival. I really want to do it again.
And that was your first time in New Orleans.
That was my first time in New Orleans.
But it was the festival's first time in New Orleans as well.
It was for both of us.
Yeah.
It was the first time.
So, first screening. Nobody had any idea what to expect.
So I was kind of just panic stricken, and then afterwards it was kind of clear that at least like a large portion of the audience really liked it, and then there were some tweets that happened, and it was very, very, very exciting. But it was, you know, first it was just a relief that people
didn't hate it.
And then we had a second screening the next night at the Mark Theater, which was bigger than the first screening, which was at the Egyptian, which is a really beautiful theater, but very small.
And old, and not
the best sound system at Sundance. Like one of the speakers wasn't really working that night. That was contributing to my panic, you know, but then the next night we had this screening at the Mark, which was just, I don't know if it was because people had, like, you know, that there was some word of mouth or people had talked about it a bit, but then that was just from the very beginning, scenes that were never really meant to be that, like, they're not like particularly sensational and they weren't meant to be that scary.
Right.
Or at least not compared to what happens later,
but
people were screaming and it was very audible. And then there's something that happens like 30 minutes into the film that kind of changes everything. And from there, it was just, you could really feel that the audience was with it, and it was very palpable. And I had never had that experience as a filmmaker, and it was really, it was really just wonderful. And kind of a life-changing night.
And a career-changing night, no doubt. Suddenly, this movie is what everybody's talking about. It's coming out shortly, and all these things happened before the movie even coming out. Now, you had done several short films, a couple in particular that got a lot of attention. They were dark, but they're not really what people would call horror films. They weren't supernatural in nature.
No.
But they're very dramatic, and to me, that's the best kind of horror film when it comes from your gut and your heart and from the humanity of the characters. And this cast you managed to assemble for this. Tell me first, were you a fan of the horror genre before you pursued this movie?
Yeah. Look, like when I was 12 and 13, I was obsessed with horror films, and I just exhausted the horror section of like every video store that I could find, I'm young, but it's just funny how video stores are like this antiquated.
They're done. They're gone.
But I still hard to believe. And so I was just obsessed with horror films, and I remember that I had this like binder full of just like pages that I printed up that were like badly printed, like just images from Google, from, you know, like Pinhead or this.
Wow.
I then felt kind of off, and I have not been somebody who watches every horror film that comes out for a long time. I'll watch the ones that I'm like directed towards, and that's because a lot of horror films these days, but I don't think this is anything new, are produced, you know, pretty cynically.
Right. They're the cheap seats.
Exactly.
The lowest common denominator. It's easy to throw blood and viscera at a screen and call it a horror movie.
Yeah. There are like, you know, kind of these, these these demands that you just have to meet. And right. if you meet them, then the film will be somewhat profitable, maybe, probably.
Right.
If you spend this much and you do these things.
The formula, then, make it for teenagers. And
exactly.
And, yeah.
And so,
with teenagers and for teenagers.
Yeah. Right. And so, you know, I feel like that trend has like maybe given the genre kind of a bad name. But again, it's nothing new. Those films were being made in the 80s. They're being made, you know, like B movies in the 50s,
right?
In the
60s and 50s. Yeah. I mean, in the 60s, when they found out people like Herschel Gordon Lewis could do something and just have piles of blood and viscera, and it became so controversial these days, it's kind of the norm.
Exactly. And so, you know, for me, that's one thing. But then I think back on the horror films that like really made an impact on me, like when I was very young, and they're as good as anything. I mean,
what were they? Yeah.
Well, you know, first there are the films that I just love, that I just think are great, and they never really scared me, but I love them. Like Jack Clayton's The Innocents.
Oh, beautiful film.
Yeah, I love that film. And The Uninvited.
Yeah.
And then
that's 1945. We're going back.
Exactly. Yeah. No, I mean, you can go all the way back to, you know, to Val Lewton. And
yeah,
I love those films, but then I,
so they're atmospheric, psychologically driven.
Well, in some cases,
scary,
you know,
stories.
Yeah.
Well, those two in particular.
For the most case,
or The Haunting.
For the most part. I mean, yeah, well, The Haunting I like a lot. I think, you know, Rosemary's Baby is as well directed as any film I've ever seen.
I agree. I mean, people talk about, they're comparing your film to The Exorcist. I feel much more akin to Rosemary's Baby when I see Hereditary.
I'd probably prefer that.
okay.
I really love The Exorcist, but I really love Rosemary's Baby.
Yeah.
Just even the way that Polanski, like, just his blocking in relation to the camera is something that I like have studied more than probably anything else.
Well, that famous shot on the telephone where she's off camera and the audience actually craned their neck to look around to see her.
Oh yeah,
to see
the famous shot,
the film.
Right?
Yeah,
but beyond that, just scene for scene, the way that he moves his actors, and the way that then motivates the camera to move. It's so invisible, but it's like athletic. For me, you know, there are the three films by him that are just like perfect, which is that Macbeth and Rosemary and Chinatown.
Oh,
And then before that, you have like Cul-de-Sac. And Repulsion.
The Tenant is pretty amazing too.
The Tenant is great.
Repulsion.
Yeah. The Tenant
is probably the first one I saw. Yeah.
Right, and then the Tenant gets better or worse based on the dubbing you're watching it with, right? But Rosemary's Baby is a really big one. Don't Look Now is probably the film that I was referencing the most when I was talking about this film.
Interesting.
I see this as sort of a spiritual sibling or a spiritual cousin to that film. What else? I love The Shining, but I've always considered that to be more of like a black comedy than a horror film.
Yeah.
And
I don't talk about The Shining.
Yeah. Yeah, right. Exactly. Well, as far as like atmosphere is concerned.
No, I think it's a great Kubrick film.
Right, it's just not a Stephen King film.
It's not a Stephen King adaptation, really.
No, it's I mean, he's pared everything down. It becomes almost an essay on the genre.
On cinema.
More than a contribution. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. In fact, it's kind of poking the genre in the eye in certain ways.
Oh, it is. I mean, it's stripping everything to its bare essentials. And that's why I don't find it scary. I just find it like endlessly fascinating. But then I would say, to get back to your question, well, the two films as a kid that like wrecked me were De Palma's Carrie. Peter Greenaway's The Cook, the Thief, His Wife, and Her Lover.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is not technically a horror film.
No, but it's pretty horrific.
Yeah, it's like, it's deeply horrific, and it's like, it's just, I consider him to be like our most authentic misanthrope.
No. Yes, Peter Greenaway.
Yeah, yeah. People talk about Lars von Trier being a misanthrope, and you could say a million things about Lars von Trier.
Like right.
I haven't seen the house that Jack built. Let's
no, but I'm, we're I'm, hearing I'm a lot about that.
Yeah, yeah, but there's his films are always so deeply felt, and even as he's like torturing his characters, there's like a real empathy there. And with Peter Greenaway, there is not. Like, his films are so highly aestheticized, and he's so obsessed with artifice, and they're gorgeous. I mean, you have, like, Sasha Vierney shooting these films, and you have Michael Nyman's music, and in the case of The Cook, The Thief, you have, I think, Jean-Paul Gaultier, like, doing the costumes.
The costumes, yeah.
But you really feel that these people are like, just these, like, pawns. I mean, only in The Cook, The Thief, do we even really get performances from him? Like Helen Mirren and Michael Gambon, and they're very like, you know, they're great performances, even if they are still very distant, you know, and clinical. Mm-hmm.
But otherwise, the most interesting movies are about people.
Exactly.
And I think, you know, are you particularly drawn to British filmmakers? I know Mike Lee is one of your favorite. He's a working class filmmaker about the working class almost always.
He is. I mean, almost always.
Naked is an amazing movie.
Well, Naked's maybe my favorite, but then I get going and it's like, well, maybe Topsy-Turvy's my favorite, or maybe yes. Secrets and Lies, or maybe Happy-Go-Lucky.
You're right. Wait, yeah. That's a tough choice here.
Yeah, or just a couple of years ago, Mr. Turner. He's amazing. Mike Lee is maybe my favorite filmmaker. And I don't know who else can work the way he does, where he has like 6 months with actors just to find the characters and to find their history and to build these relationships like brick by brick, and then to go off and write the script, and then, you know.
Yeah, after working with the actors and having them inform what the script is going to be.
Right, and working with the best actors in the world.
Yes.
Right, and so I don't know, it's hard to really, it's hard to like learn from him in that way, except I just see his films and, you know, those characters are so vivid, and you feel their histories and you feel their relationships.
His films are quite experiential.
They are. You know? They are. And people don't talk enough about him as an aesthete, because his films are gorgeous.
And they're amazing.
Beautifully made. I mean, you know, he's got Dick Pope shooting his films, and mm-hmm. Dick Pope's over here doing The Matrix, you know, but
the genre fans may not know Mike Lee very well, but I mean, film fans and genre fans who don't should, just because the films are so informed by deep psychological character studies.
Yeah, it's true. And I can say that on this film, when I was showing films to the crew, I kind of made sure not to show horror films. I was showing them family dramas that for me were kind of working in the same register that I wanted to at least like have Hereditary start in, you know, so we would watch like All or Nothing by Mike Lee and Secrets and Lies, and we watched In the Bedroom, which has sort of a turn at the 30-minute mark, which is not far away from
right,
what happens
right.
here.
Well, atmospherically, it reminds me a lot of Ang Lee's The Ice Storm.
Yeah,
which
that was a big one.
Is a beautifully made, incredibly heartbreaking.
Oh yeah, it's perfect.
Deeply tragic movie.
Yeah, no, and that was actually the first film we screened.
Ah, okay, good.
And when I was pitching it, I would often pitch it as The Ice Storm, you know, meets, I don't know, Rosemary's Baby or something,
right.
Or whatever you,
right.
Yeah. The Ice Storm is one of my favorite films, and we watched Bergman too. We watched a lot of Bergman films.
Wow.
And then we watched Cries and Whispers and Autumn Sonata, which is, you know, about a mother-daughter relationship
right.
In a different way than this one is. But
well, it sounds like you spent a long time working your way up to making this movie, that there was years of pre-production rather than just the usual weeks of pre-production for this.
Well, you know, by the time this one had gotten going, I had written like 10 feature scripts. So there, and I'd been trying to get a few of them made for a long time. And actually, the reason I wrote this, because I wrote this pretty late, was because it began kind of cynically, where I just realized like I would have an easier time getting a horror film made.
And then
the question becomes, well, how do you, like, okay, so what do I want from the horror genre? Like, you know, and then it becomes less and less cynical until it becomes deeply personal. And then it's just like anything else that I, you know, that I've written. But
are you drawn to tragedy? Are you drawn to darker stories overall? I mean, your output indicates that you would be.
Yeah, I would never like announce it as like a mission. You know what I mean?
mission statement is to bring people down and bum them out. Yeah,
no, exactly. But I recognize like that seems to be what I'm doing, especially with the shorts that I'd made.
Well, tell me about the road to getting this movie made, because I'd read things about how your process, you had already shot-listed the whole movie before you started and things like that, which obviously changes day to day when you're actually in production on a movie.
It does. It does. And in this case, it didn't change too much because, yes, so I always compose a shot list first. Before I talk to anybody in the crew. So I typically spend a few months devising a shot list. And then when I'm done, I'll go to my cinematographer and my production designer. In this case, that was Pavel Pogorzelski, who I've been working with for a long time, and Grace Yoon, who is the production designer, and she's great. Beautiful. Oh, yeah. She did a wonderful job. And I'll then go... scene by scene and take them through what the blocking is and what the shots will be. And all the shots are sequenced. So it very, very seldom will we get, coverage. I mean, if you do like a dinner table scene, which there is one here, you will get coverage.
But there will be scenes that play through in a single shot that's moving and that is constantly shifting its sense of focus during the course of the scene.
Exactly. And what happens when you do that is that you then find that it's very hard to find a location. So we spent a long time scouting, and then it became very clear that that we were not going to find a house that catered to this shot list. And I had been used to sort of building things on my shorts, which I'd been making since AFI. I graduated from AFI as a director about 8 years ago.
Yeah, we'll talk about your film school experience at AFI, which is such a great launching pad and such a great source of experience. But this whole thing about finding locations and the like, obviously you had an exterior location.
Well, we did have an exterior location, and we shot there for about 3 days. But then for everything interior, that's the first floor, the second floor, the attic, and then everything to do with the treehouse, the interior and the exterior. We actually built two interiors for that, one that's smaller and one that's larger. Everything was built.
It was
from
all
scratch.
On sound stages.
Yeah. All in a sound stage in Utah, in Park City. And we built everything from scratch. What made it even more difficult from there was that we were also going to have to replicate all of these spaces with the dollhouses.
Right, the miniatures, which I want to talk about as well. But the flexibility, I mean, you needed to be on stages to do what you did in this movie.
Yeah.
It would have been impossible for you to go onto a location and do the things that you did. You'd have to walk, knock holes in walls and all of that sort of stuff.
No, we would. It would have been impossible, and I think we knew that, but I think we just wanted to prove it to ourselves by like looking for this perfect location that didn't exist, with halls that would accommodate like a dolly and then doorways that would allow the dolly to go in and out, but to shoot the film as fluidly as we wanted to, we were always going to have to build, and even right now. I'm in pre-production on a film in Hungary, and we're building a village,
A whole village.
Yeah,
nice. Well, it's cheaper to do in Hungary than in Park City.
It's true.
Yeah, but what a great circle that you shot it in Park City, and then it had its premiere at Sundance in Park City, and I mean, what an ironic and wonderful, beautiful circle for you.
It really was wonderful. And you know, Utah was a place that we chose because it was going to be cheaper. And it's very beautiful there. But what we found was that it was such an ideal place to shoot this film. We had the most amazing crew.
You know, we were based, when we shot The Stand, we were based in Utah.
Oh, yeah.
And I actually shot scenes from The Stand at Sundance. And, so, yeah.
And how was that for you?
It was fantastic.
Yeah.
I mean, it was very Mormon, you know, being based in Salt Lake City rather than in Park City.
Well, we were actually based in Salt Lake City for all of pre-production, and we shot the first 2 weeks in Salt Lake. So I know Salt Lake better than I do Park City as a place to make a movie.
Yeah, I spent 6 or 7 months there in pre-production and production on The Stand.
So wow. I loved it. I was surprised.
Yeah, I had a great experience. The crew was fantastic, and actually shooting at Park City before at Sundance before Sundance really was what it has become.
And it's obviously so beautiful. I mean, everybody, you know, I feel like Park City has that reputation, but Salt Lake doesn't necessarily have that reputation.
No.
But Salt Lake is amazing because it is wherever you're standing, you are surrounded completely by mountains. It's this 360. And that's why the air is not very good there. Is because
yes,
it's trapped. It's all trapped in.
Yeah.
But it's, I when we left Utah, I was kind of sad. I got really
how long were you there?
Yeah. I think we had about 10 weeks of pre-production, and then it was about a 30-day shoot.
Really? That's quick for something that says, I mean, it's contained.
Yeah. Well, that's why designing it is so important.
Right.
Because we really didn't have time to find anything on set. We were just doing we were just shooting the plans.
Well, were there things that came up that did shot? I mean, I find when I'll usually shot list the week that's coming up the weekend before. Because everything changes so often, the chaos hits that I don't want to be a slave to a shot list rather than the other way around. Did you find things that kind of threw you off kilter because you couldn't do your plan?
Yeah. I mean, it's funny. You know, there were scenes that I had shot listed to a T, and I knew them like in my bones, and we sort of built a lot of the spaces to accommodate those scenes. Mm-hmm. And those scenes tended to never really change because I had lived with them for so long.
It was created around the shot list. Yeah,
exactly. But then there were scenes that, you know, when you're shot listing, you can feel like this works, but like, I don't know. And then if you shoot them that way, typically those are the scenes that you're the least happy with. If there's anything that you're not certain of, if there's anything you can't see 100% in your head, I find if you're working this way, those are always the scenes that that either end up on the cutting room floor or that you need to reshoot or that just end up in the movie because you need them in the movie because they have information that you can't
and you go, oh,
lose.
Shit.
And it's like that shouldn't be in the movie because then you end up losing, you end up cutting scenes that you love the way that they're shot, but they're not necessary. And then this necessary scene just isn't of this. It's not meeting the standard that you've been trying to set for.
And then the actors will bring something to the stage that can be entirely unexpected, no matter how much you've rehearsed.
Of course,
and that's what you welcome, right?
Well, absolutely. I mean, I know that the way that I've been working so far can be annoying for actors because I come in with the blocking,
right? Very Hitchcockian style. That's how he used to plan everything.
Yeah,
so although, he didn't even enjoy the process of shooting. He was done by the time.
No, and I'm not sure if I do. It's so stressful for me. But I try to shot list in a way that kind of gives the actor freedom within the frame, so that it's like, these are the things that need to happen, but please, I tell them, please mix it up however you want.
Yeah,
but I think that might even sound disingenuous or be disingenuous because ultimately they are locked into this trajectory. And, mm-hmm. And I would love to find a way to work that's, I'm a little bit that's looser in that way because you want ultimately what needs to happen is for the performances to be of a level that you want to be filming them,
and, right?
As opposed to them kind of, you know, being subservient to a shot.
Well,
I'm hoping you land in the middle.
Yeah. Your first time as a feature director, and it's worked for you very well so far, and giving you the opportunity to try all kinds of new things. I mean, yeah.
I'm excited to loosen up. I'm excited to like find.
Yeah.
The confidence to loosen up a bit.
You're getting unlocked.
Yeah.
So tell me about the AFI experience, how that happened, how you got into the program, and how you feel that helped your cinematic education as a guy. Because, you know, you can be a really bright person who understands the language of cinema and not be able to feed that to other people and share it with other people, a cast and crew. So tell me what you learned in the process of the AFI system.
Well, I can say first the beauty of AFI is that it's very practical. It's all practice based.
AFI meaning the American Film Institute.
Yeah. Exactly. The American Film Institute Conservatory, which I went there right after college. I was very young. Most people they ask that applicants spend some years in the industry, and I hadn't. Again, the beauty of the program is that you go in to a particular discipline. I was there as a director. They have 28 directors every year. They have 28 writers, 28 producers, 28 cinematographers, and then 14 production designers and 14 editors.
Wow.
And
this is all housed in a former nunnery in the Hollywood Hills.
Exactly. Yeah. Near Los Feliz or Los Feliz. People will correct you if you say Los Feliz.
Yeah. Although that's the correct pronunciation for Spanish. Los Feliz.
So you're there, within your discipline, and the first year you make three films, you make three cycle films, unless you're an editor or a production designer, in which case you make two for each cycle, so you make six cycle films, and you screen your short for the entire class, and then you have to sit up on stage as they critique what they just saw, and you sit up there with a professor. We had Frank Pearson at that point. Now, and that was amazing. Yeah. Frank Pearson, who wrote
Dog Day Afternoon
and Cool Hand Luke.
Amazing history.
And so he was great. But then you'd be torn apart by your class, and then you have to hustle to get the team you want for the next cycle. And so it's
very competitive. And a class of would-be directors would be very critical of your work,
yeah.
Right?
Oh, yeah.
Did you find yourself shredded?
Yeah, I found myself shredded. I found myself doing shredding, you know. And then it becomes very competitive where that cycle had really great cinematography, so everybody wants that cinematographer for their next cycle. Or if you made, a really shitty cycle, then you're toxic waste until you're not, right? Until the next thing you make, which is hopefully better. It can be a very brutal program. I really liked it. And then for your second year, you make your thesis film, hopefully with the team you want. What happens for the theses is that everybody can submit a script anonymously. So that could be a production designer, an editor, it doesn't matter what your discipline is. And you submit scripts to be thesis films, and they end up greenlighting 28 of them. And I was lucky in that my script was greenlit pretty early on, and it was a very weird short called Strange Thing with the Johnsons.
Right. And you were able to direct your own script then.
I was able to direct my own script. The thing I made was pretty out there, and then kind of found this weird this audience online.
Yeah, yeah, very successful online. But you also were able, because of the AFI, you were able to work with high caliber actors in these films as well, and familiar actors too.
In some cases, yeah. I mean, you're going through like SAG books, right?
And so Screen Actors Guild, yeah.
Exactly. And
rather than your best friend down the street who works as a barista, but he's really funny, and we'll put him in this movie. You
know? Exactly. and that's what was really beautiful about AFI for me was that I had just gotten out of undergrad. I went to film school in Santa Fe. At the College of Santa Fe, which is now, I forget what it's called. I think it's the Santa Fe Institute of Art and Design now or something like that.
Okay.
I think I might have gotten that wrong. But in undergrad, my experience was if you want to make a film, like you're doing everything, and everybody who's on set is doing you a big favor and you owe them, and they have no investment whatsoever in what you're making. And the beauty of AFI is that everybody who's involved, it's their project. So the DP, the production designer, this is their showcase as well. Right. And so everybody was invested, and it was the first time that I was able to actually direct, meaning where I was having to articulate a vision to everybody.
To professionals.
Yeah, exactly.
To people who knew what they were doing in each of their departments.
Yeah. Exactly. And that was really, really invaluable. I think I probably got the equivalent of like 5 years of experience in those two.
So AFI allowed you to communicate the language of cinema to the other people who were working with you on your film.
Yeah, and it allowed me to sort of try things that I'd wanted to try and learn what worked and what didn't. And I loved so many different films, and I wanted to try so many different kinds of, I loved Michael Haneke, and I wanted to be Michael Haneke. And then I found that, I shot a short that was like very static and like lots of wides and very clinical. And I was getting bored with my own film. I realized that I just wanted to move the camera more, and I wanted to be, I wanted the camera to be more like athletic.
And you didn't want to just emulate other filmmakers.
No, but that's how you find it. Is that
you're inspired by them?
But you all. I mean, I don't know how other people work, but I certainly started by emulating filmmakers. I was emulating Michael Haneke, and I was emulating Roy Anderson, and then I was trying to do my version of like early Scorsese, and then you end up finding
your voice, or just your
aesthetic, right?
Yeah.
Like whatever, and that gets more and more concrete as you keep.
How would you describe your aesthetic, the Ari Aster aesthetic?
I don't know. I love moving the camera. I love color. I really like artifice. Certainly when I'm working in horror, the films that like always bothered me the most are the ones that kind of felt the most artificial. Like Peter Greenaway, there's nobody who has a more like artificial sense, right? But then and then I love musicals, but especially the ones that disturbed me, like Pennies from Heaven.
Oh, that's great.
And there's like a real Brechtian sense of of distance there.
Well, there's also a darkness that of theme that seems to be consistent in, well, you've done one movie, but you've done the other shorts as well.
Yeah.
And which is why I asked you about if you are drawn to darkness, and has personal tragedy played a part in your life, because it seems to play such a part in your films?
I would say maybe less in mine than people I love.
Which includes you.
Well, of course, includes me, course. But then...
I mean, I...
Yeah, I... Yes, I... But at the same time, like, I... Yeah, I, no, certainly.
And tragedy certainly deepens you as an artist, whether you're a writer or a filmmaker or whatever. I know I've lost a couple of brothers and people close to me and parents and all. And as painful as it is, I appreciate the deepening process that happens during that, which is what I found in your film, too, is well, that felt so personal about it. Because that tragedy of loss, Toni Collette has such an amazing, horrific response to a certain point in the film that just it feels so deeply rooted. How much of that was her and how much of that was you?
I mean, it's all in the script, and then she just was absolutely able to embody that. I was definitely working through very personal feelings. And you know, that's sort of the beauty of genre filmmaking is that you can put them through this filter and it becomes something else because there are these demands that you have to meet. And so ultimately, nobody in the film is a surrogate for anybody in my family or you know, for me.
Right.
But no, the film is definitely coming from like a very raw place. It was a very therapeutic process to write it and then to make it. I want the film to be sorrowful. Like I always wanted to make a very sorrowful,
experience,
sad film.
To make it hurt.
Make it hurt. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm happy to hear that people are having that experience watching the film, that they are struck on a deep level. In that way too, I think the film also has like great debts to the domestic melodrama. Maybe even more than the horror genre.
Well, that's an interesting point. I think we should talk about is the requirements of the horror genre or the freedoms of the horror genre, because you're encouraged to use the tools of cinema in an exaggerated, artificial way, perhaps, that you could not get away with in drama. And here you embrace the human drama so beautifully and emotionally and use these tools of otherworldly and internally felt emotional processes that would be difficult to convey cinematically in a drama that you can get away with in a film dealing with the supernatural.
Yeah. Well, you know, I even as I was pitching the film, and I've said this before, but I was not describing it as a horror film. I was describing it as a family tragedy that curdles into a nightmare in the same way that life can feel like a nightmare when disaster strikes, especially when it strikes in succession, right? Like that saying, when it rains, it pours.
Mm-hmm.
When it rains, it pours. And so I wanted the film to honor those feelings by attaching itself sympathetically to them and kind of becoming as extreme as the feelings themselves.
Mm.
So to not be, you know, the observational camera that's like outside the door watching the person go through hell, but for the film to attach itself to that experience and then
to be participatory.
And, yeah. Exactly. And then for the film to almost collapse under the weight of those feelings. Mm. I remember talking about how I wanted the film to sort of feel like the film was coming apart at the seams because it couldn't contain the feelings inside. And then at the end,
that were so raw,
it just goes crazy.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we only have a couple of minutes to go. I see. So I just really, it's important to touch on the casting process. I mean, Toni Collette, Gabriel Byrne, Millie Shapiro, where did she come from? Charlie. I mean, she's amazing, unique, fantastic.
Yeah. Well, Millie Shapiro is absolutely incredible, and we found her in an audition. I was always really worried about Charlie. I didn't know if we would be able to find her. I had something in my head. I knew that I had to sort of let go of that and just see what came. And I never could have anticipated finding anybody as good as Millie and as perfect as Millie.
And as unique.
And as unique as Millie, but also as unique as Millie in her talent, because she is, she has a Tony, which she won when she was 10 years old for playing Matilda on Broadway.
Amazing.
Amazing. Yeah. And she's an incredible singer. And she's just, she's a Broadway actress, but she's her instincts are just incredible. And she's such a smart actress. And I remember she came in with an idea about the character and she tried something and it wasn't quite right. And then I gave her one note and it wasn't a very special note. And then she did it again and it was just, whoa. Like it was
her perceptions
perfect.
Were amazing.
She was so smart and she brought so much more to the part than I had written. And then Alex Wolff, who plays Peter, mm-hmm. he also came in and auditioned and he was incredible.
A musician.
Yeah. Also a musician, and he's been kind of in front of the camera since he was very, very young with his mm-hmm. brother, Nat. I mean, I didn't know that he was part of this Naked Brothers band when I first cast him.
Right.
But he's an amazingly dedicated actor who, I know he doesn't like me saying that he's method, but that's how he
but
works.
But he kind of is.
Yeah, I mean, he dives headfirst in, and he was essentially Peter for 2 months, which is really fun for a director because then you get to just talk to the character,
right,
as
right.
opposed to the actor,
right.
Then Tony and Gabriel. Tony came on really early.
Oh, really? They're both actors of incredible heft and incredible breadth in their work. And she in particular has been through the genre as well once or twice.
Yeah, she has. I had been watching them since I was a kid, and so it was just kind of a dream come true to have them come onto the film, and it was very intimidating. And Tony came on about it.
Aren't they both Australian?
He's Irish.
Oh, he's Irish and she's Australian.
And she's Australian.
Because I remember seeing her in Muriel's Wedding, and it's like, what a transformation from that.
She was like 19 or so. Yeah. She was very young. She might have been like 20. When Tony came on, you know, we sent her the script and we met and she attached herself. I mean, that's when the movie becomes real. So that was my first experience as a filmmaker, feeling real significant momentum, because there were so many projects that had started to go and just didn't go. And so it was life-changing to have her come onto the film. And then getting Gabriel and Anne was just,
from Handmaid's Tale and everything.
She's incredible. And she's also just the sweetest person in the world.
Which you wouldn't guess from Handmaids, but she plays a totally opposite kind of character there, sort of.
Yeah.
But what I also like is the way you flip the characters. Gabriel is kind of an ineffectual male character, whereas Tony, her character, is pretty all-encompassing for the course of the film.
Yeah, thank you. He's just trying to hold things together.
Just trying ineffectively.
Yeah, he has no concept of the forces that are encroaching on this family and just what he's kind of married into. But yeah.
Well, it's a great accomplishment, and I know we've got to wrap it up now, but I really appreciate talking to you about this and watching to see what comes next. So thanks so much for joining us on Postmortem.
Thank you so much for having me. This was great.
Thanks, Ari. If you're enjoying Postmortem, it would be a great, great favor to us for you to rate and review and subscribe on iTunes or your favorite podcast app. You can access all of my video interviews and behind-the-scenes documentaries, things like that, at mickgarrisinterviews.com. Reach us on Twitter at PostmortemMG and on Instagram on PostmortemGram. Thanks a lot for listening.
Thanks for listening to Postmortem with Mick Garris. Download new episodes every other Wednesday and subscribe on iTunes.